Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi and welcome to the podcast. I hope you've had a good week. Whatever's going on for you. I had such a great response to the podcast last week. Thank you so much, Kaz. Sometimes, you know, it's the podcast that you weren't expecting to land with quite the amount of power that they did. But I think there was just something about Kaz's vulnerability that landed with so many people. I had some really lovely messages. So thank you again, Kaz, you know, for sharing your story. And it really makes such a difference. And also, I really appreciate it when you let me know that you've enjoyed a podcast, or, you know, if you can share it with your friends, it really makes a massive difference. So thank you to everyone who listened and shared it. And thank you for the feedback. Within the Sober Club, quite a few people said they actually, you know, shed a few tears at Kaz's story, but you know, inspirational nonetheless. One woman said she listened to the podcast when she was out and about, and then on her headphones, and then ended up having to have a little sit down on a park bench and have a little cry. So much so that somebody else, are you okay? But you know, this other people's stuff can get to us, right? And I think there's just so much in this sharing of stories, and that, you know, as Johan Harry says, the opposite of addiction is connection, and being connected and being able to share your story and to know that somebody else has walked a similar path, or one even perhaps more tough than the one you're walking. You know, I love that phrase. Never, you know, you can't possibly know where someone's at till you've walked a mile in their shoes, right? Anyways, on that note, I have another wonderful guest for you this week who, again, I think you're going to find this one a bit emotional, perhaps, but definitely inspirational. I'm going to be interviewing Emma Campbell, Limitless M, as she is known. And man alive, what a story she has. So I really hope that's going to help a lot of people. Before we do that, I just want to comment on something that's literally just happened today. Is I got a message from someone that I'm working with, someone that I'm doing some coaching with, a Sober Club member, and she was asking about something coming up in a few weeks. She's quite early days in terms of ditching the booze, and she's been, you know, she has the opportunity to go to an event in a few weeks. She's not in the UK, she's in the States, so I guess lockdown rules are different. But nonetheless, it made me think, actually, I know there's a lot of people going through some level of anxiety about how things are going to be when they open up, when they come out of their actual bubble, rather than forming a bubble of six or whatever we do in the future. People can be a little bit anxious, because if you've ditched the booze over lockdown, that's become your default setting, that, you know, you live your life a certain way. And when you're thrown out into the wild, as it were, it might feel a bit scary. So I thought I'd just share with you what our conversation. And it went along the lines of, she has been invited to an event, you know, a family event. With and she knows what this event will be like. You know, she said that there'll be sort of champagne and wine with dinner and you know, mimosas and, you know, this, that and the other. And it all sounded so lovely and glamorous and alcohol fueled. And as she said, she didn't feel confident to start having discussions with her family around the fact that she'd, you know, she was ditching the booze. And her question really was, should I decline? Should I decline the invitation and, you know, stay home, make an excuse, you know, because it's early days. And my answer to her was, well, obviously, you have to do what you feel is right for you. Of course you do. This is entirely your call. And I do know people who really made their choice, you know, early on. Okay, first, whatever it is, sort of 30 days even, I'm going to pretty much hole up. Okay, if I have to go to work or whatever, then so be it. But I'm not going to go to any social things. I'm not going to put myself out there in terms of being tempted, in terms of having the conversations I don't want to have. I'm really going to hole up and get strong. And that works for some people. But for others, you know, it doesn't work. And there really is a sense of, let's step into the identity of being a non-drinker. And let's do that with all the sober tools that we have. So what I suggested to her was that she, you know, asked herself that question, what feels right for you? What does your kind of gut say? Because she had added the fact that one part of her really wants to go, partly because she had been very isolated and she really would love some company, and partly because there were going to be some children there that, you know, part of the family that she really wanted to see. So, you know, you can kind of read between the lines there and know that actually human connection is, as we've just been saying, is so important. So I suggested to her that she absolutely asks what her gut instinct is. And if there is a little bit of, well, I'd really love to go, but I'm a bit concerned, then put in place the WHOOP. I know I've mentioned this a ton of times, and I go through it in detail in my book, in Happy, Healthy, Sober. And, you know, what I suggested to her was she does a WHOOP for this one event. So what's the wish? The first, you know, the W stands for wish. What does she want? And that's the top line. So along the lines of, I want to have a great time at this family event, alcohol free, you know, and happy. That kind of idea. The second letter, the second O, stands for outcome. And that's where you put the detail in. So what will that look like then? What will be the outcome? If I get that wish, what will it look like? And that's where you've really got to visualize yourself in that setting. You know, throw your mind's eye forward and ask yourself, what will it be like? You know, visualize the setting. What will you be wearing? See yourself smiling, talking to the other people at that event, see yourself eating a nice meal or just having fun. Just visualize it, get a sense of how that will feel. How will it feel when you get home and you're super proud of yourself that you've achieved your wish? And then the next O stands for obstacle. So realistically, what will it be that will trip you up? Is it the family member who says, don't be ridiculous, just have one, and thrusts the glass in your hand? You know, will it be your own urges and cravings that force you to listen to the voice in your head that says, oh, for goodness sake, you can enjoy yourself. You got this now anyway. Of course, you can just have one. What will it be? Be really honest and realistic about that. And then the P of the WHOOP stands for plan. And this, of course, is the really important one and will take as many pages as it takes. And in the case of my client, we did a whole ton of stuff around the plans along the lines of, plan ahead exactly what you will say to other people. And it's your choice. And if you want to fib, fib, who cares? It doesn't matter. What's important is that this is non-negotiable. So you absolutely do not have to have a conversation with family members or anyone at all about what you're doing. It's not their business. And I strongly recommend that you don't have too many of these discussions early on, because they can be really detrimental. If you're feeling a bit fragile, you don't need other people's views right now at this point. You just need the support of like-minded people, of people who have already done this or are on the same path. You know, that's where the Sober Club is so amazing, because we've all been there, done it, got the t-shirt, or we're at the early stages, so we know how people are feeling. But our own family and friends, well, maybe they're not at the same stage and they don't understand. They're not in your shoes. They're not walking your path. So absolutely don't spell everything out, unless you really want to, of course. Far better to just say one small thing, but say it in advance. Send a text in advance or an email or have a phone call that just gives people a heads up. Oh, by the way, I'm not drinking any alcohol. And that's it. You can give a reason if you want. You can say, I'm on medication, I'm this, I'm that, I'm driving. That's always a great one. Or you can be honest and say, I'm not drinking. It makes me feel better when I don't. I'm less anxious, or it, you know, seriously doesn't matter what the reason is, but decide the reason you're going to give, and that's it. It's one line and that's it. And don't enter into big discussions. If people say, oh, come on, let's have a conversation about this. What do you mean you're not drinking? You can just smile sweetly and say, hey, you know, let's discuss it some other time. By the way, where's the cake? Or whatever. So planning ahead is really important. Planning to leave early because you sure as heck will get bored. You know, the sober equals bores. No, I don't think so. It's the drunk people who are boring, and you will want to leave early, almost certainly. So make your excuses in advance. A great thing to do is to have something prepped for the next morning so that you've got to leave super early because you've got to get a good night's sleep because you're doing something the next day, and you'll want to be feeling good for that. So prep ahead and let people know that you're going to be leaving early. So that gives you an exit clause, as it were. And obviously, the big one, prep ahead exactly what you are going to drink. Now, you know what I'm going to say. Keep the ritual. Change the ingredients. While everyone else is having their seemingly sophisticated, glamorous drinks and their champagne and whatever it is, a cup of tea, a glass of water, a lime and soda probably won't cut it. Now, you may think in advance that it will. Oh, I'll be fine with a cup of tea. But in the moment when your unconscious mind, when your little inner toddler wants to also feel like they're being celebratory and having fun, it will all go bad if you've only prepped ahead for a cup of tea. So take great alcohol-free drinks with you, or the ingredients to mix yourself up something fabulous. I really believe that's so important. Take stuff with you. You know, prep that bit in advance, and ideally take more than you need, because chances are the drinkers will want a little taste of what you're having, particularly when they've had a few drinks. They're going to really love the idea of your gorgeous bottle of whatever it might be. So absolutely prep ahead. So I really hope that helps somebody else who's got something coming up, something specific. Do that whoop. It's what is the wish? What's the outcome? What will it look like? What's the obstacle? What will trip you up, if anything? And how do you prep ahead? And really, you know, put the P in place. P for plan, P for prep. And don't skip that bit. It's so important. So on that note, talking about the importance of keeping the ritual, change the ingredients, we've teamed up with a company who are just fab. I mean, I love these products. The branding is gorgeous. Everything about it is just great. So we've got a fabulous competition to win highball alcohol-free cocktails. And I thought it would be really lovely just to have a chat with the founder. You know, I love getting under the skin of these great brands. And I found Kate fascinating. So we're going to be hearing in a while from Limitless M, as we call her. But right now, let's hear from Kate. Welcome, Kate. Kate Johnson is co-founder of Highball Cocktails. Kate, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got going in all of this.
Well, we founded Highball Cocktails back in autumn 2019. And when I say we, I mean me and my husband, Red. We're both co-founders of the business. And it was just one of those kind of, it'd probably been brewing for a while, to be honest. I had a career in marketing. So for a long time, I worked in a branding agency where I was creating new products, new brands, brand launches. And I loved it. I was really passionate about it. Was, and probably still am, a bit of a nightmare to go shopping with, because I'll walk down the supermarket aisles and say, "Oh, that's new. How have they done that? You know, yeah. What's the consumer insight?"
That's the wrong logo.
Exactly. Love it. And I worked across all different kinds of sectors, some tech, some banking. But where I did a lot of work and particularly felt at home was in FMCG, so consumer products, and particularly in food and drink, which is probably where my passion lies, really. Mm. I left the agency and had kids. We've got two children. And Red's background is in drinks, really. I mean, he grew up in it. His father is a wine critic, wine writer called Hugh Johnson. Don't know if you've heard of him, but he wrote the Pocket Wine Guide, which is probably the world's best-selling wine book. He sold over 20 million wine books. So Red's very much grown up in the drinks industry, learning about wine, drinks in general. And he has a business called British Bottle Company, which is a drinks export company. So I guess those two things collide. You know, me saying, "Oh, well, children are getting a bit older. I want to get going doing something." I'd always been interested in the idea of launching my own brand. He's got all of this experience in drinks. So maybe it was inevitable that we'd have a kind of drinks baby at some point.
But why alcohol free?
I think, again, that happened. It was a kind of colliding of things that were happening for both of us. So I have never been a massive drinker. I mean, I kind of drank socially through my 20s, you know, university, when I was working in London, burning the candle at both ends. But I have to say that I never really enjoyed it. I think I always wondered if I was slightly, I don't know if you can be, but alcohol intolerant. It just didn't make me feel good.
Yeah.
And I'd see my friends, you know, having a fantastic time, talking about their hangovers and their exploits when they'd been drunk. And it just never really worked like that for me. It always just made me feel slightly unwell at the time and then the next day too. So I was one of those people that would kind of, you know, try and hide what I was drinking, or, you know, having a water and saying it was a, you know, vodka and tonic or whatever, or, you know, very much not being around when everyone was having the next round and then catching up. So I was just never drinking as much, because it just always made me feel slightly poorly.
Isn't that interesting, though, just picking up on that yeah, really is literally the outworking of that phrase, isn't it? You know, alcohol's the only drug you have to justify not taking. There, yeah, was you trying to pretend you were drinking.
Yeah, exactly. Trying to be kind of in with your friends. And, you know, yeah, particularly when you're in your 20s and you're not confident about saying, I'm not drinking because I don't want to and I don't need to. Mm. So very much, yes, kind of trying to fit in. So in a way for me, being pregnant was like the best excuse I'd ever had to be able to say, I'm not drinking. And then once the children started to grow up, I just never really went back to it particularly. So I suppose I've been kind of not alcohol free, but just not really drinking for, yeah, quite a long time now.
Yeah. So it must have been great for you when you started to realize, just, you know, that there was this trend really for so many great alcohol free drinks.
Yeah, exactly. Because I'd been drinking a lot of water, orange squash, and, you know, things like elderflower cordial, which I really like elderflower cordial, but I do find it very, very sweet and quite sickly. And I think it does get to a point where, particularly if you want to drink with other people, there's that kind of moment of occasion, isn't there, and celebration and togetherness that, you know, an orange squash just doesn't really cut it.
Yeah.
And I think also those kind of moments of preparation, I think if there's anything that I occasionally miss, it's that, you know, cold glass, the chink chink of the ice, the moment, the kind of experience of it. So starting to look at alcohol-free alternatives and, you know, trying out, there's so much out there. And then Red saying, well, you know, I've got this business, but I'd quite like to have our own brand. And it was kind of everything coming together at once, us thinking this could be a great opportunity for us to create something that I'd really like to drink. And in a way, I'm kind of a target consumer for this product. And also, you know, something that there is a growing trend for. There's, you know, there's a big market. So that's kind of how it happened.
On cocktails rather than doing an alcohol-free wine, for example.
It's definitely something that we considered. I think Red always thought that creating a really great alcohol-free wine is a very, very tough job. And I think that probably, you know, reflects back to his family's experience in wine and how great a non-alcoholic wine would have to be. I think also, you know, it's kind of trends. I think there is just a trend back to cocktail making, you know, a huge interest in it. And I think we also were quite interested in this kind of ready to drink part, because obviously highball cocktails is a ready to drink product. I think it kind of marries non-alcoholic trends, convenience, all at the same time. So you can kind of have that moment of experience, or an authentic cocktail experience, and you only really need a glass and some ice. You know, you don't need all the paraphernalia, you don't need a list of 15 different ingredients you've got to have in your fridge.
Yeah, and great for taking, you know, to friends or whatever, you know, for being social. So what about the kind of how did you decide on your ingredients and flavors then? What's the thought process there?
So I think when we decided it was going to be cocktails, we wanted to have a range of familiar cocktails. So the consumer research that we did when we were just kind of starting out pointed us in the direction that people were looking for familiar drinks. So it was kind of easier to pick an alcohol-free alternative if you kind of knew what it was supposed to taste like. So most people would know, or would have had at some point, a mojito. They kind of know what they're looking for. I think one of the things we found in the in the categories, because quite a lot of botanicals and herbals, and you know, some of them are quite expensive, and it feels quite a risky decision picking one of those things on the shelf. You don't know what it's going to taste like, you don't know if you're going to like it. So a lot of our consumer research pointed us in the direction of people saying, I want to pick, you know, I want an easy choice. So that led us in the direction of a range of kind of classic and contemporary cocktails. We've got a classic G&T, we've got an Italian spritz, which obviously plays more to the kind of Aperol spritz, you know, a bit more contemporary, pink G&T, which is again a flavour that's currently very kind of popular. And then really important to us was low sugar and as natural as possible. So there are no artificial preservatives or sweeteners in the drinks. In terms of being low sugar, compared, benchmarked against a standard cocktail, they're actually, they all of them contain less than half the calories of a standard cocktail. So that was really important to us as well. Yeah.
That's fantastic. So what's your plan then for the future? I mean, obviously, you know, we don't know what's happening with bars and all the rest of it, but, you know, lockdown notwithstanding, what's your plan?
I know, talk about a ridiculously hard time to launch a brand. Yeah. Autumn 2019, you know, we were really just getting going and then the world stopped, didn't it? So we would love to be in bars and hotels and hospitality. And that's the part of the market that has been really, really hard, and completely understandably, because nobody's wanted to be buying stock that then they just don't know how long they're going to, you know, have it before they can open again. It's been so tough. So I really hope that as lockdown eases, we will be in much more kind of on trade. What we have seen during lockdown is our own direct to consumer really pick up. So we sell on our own website, and there's been real, you know, real interest and growth in that. So we're selling a lot directly ourselves. We're also doing quite a lot of export. So it's been great to see our drinks flying around the world, you know, starting to, you know, have quite a big presence in markets like the US, in France, in the Netherlands. But, you know, what I'd really love to see is the drinks on shelf in the UK. And I very much hope that as lockdown lifts, that's going to happen. Brilliant. You know, going back to my kind of supermarket, how much I'd love to see highball cocktails on the shelves in a major supermarket.
Because of your branding experience, you know, fantastic name, you know, we can just literally in a bar and just say, I want a highball, which sounds cool. and of course, lovely branding and bottles, which was obviously very important to you.
Yes. Yeah, very much so. We actually work with one of my old friends, so it's really great to be able to connect with people that I used to work with to help us bring that brand to life. So, yeah, we love it. I mean, I think Highball is just it's very iconic. I think it's very stylish. All of that kind of old world sophistication of cocktails. That's what we're kind of trying to tap into.
Brilliant. So just remind us of the website then, where people can find out more.
So it's highballcocktails.com.
Brilliant. Thank you ever so much, Kay. I really appreciate it. And thank you for a good, great competition that you've got running with us as well. Appreciate it.
No problem. That's great. Thank you so much, Jane. It's lovely to see you and connect with you.
And you. Thank you.
All right.
So don't forget that competition is there to win a mixed case, I think it is, of the highball cocktails worth £22, I think it is. If you go to thesoberclub.com, you'll see that competition there on the blog post. Or if you look at the show notes for this podcast, you'll find that information there. And just a reminder, by the way, that we do have our Champneys events, our retreats, self-care and sobriety retreats. Well, they're wellness breaks, really. And they're at Champneys in Tring. And we're hoping, I mean, I'm touching wood and crossing everything here, that they're going to go ahead. There's one right at the end of May that may be sold out. There's one at the end of June, might be one in July, can't even remember now. And there's one in September. So there's quite a lot of opportunity. Obviously, the ones that go ahead will be the ones where we get, you know, people on the places, because there's a very small number of places available. And obviously, you know, we have to wait and see what happens with lockdown restrictions. But all being well, these events are going to go ahead. And it's a real intensive, packed kind of agenda. But it's amazing. I mean, the last one we did, people just went away feeling as though they were transformed, really, you know. And I don't put all that down to me by any means. I mean, I do the teaching. I share some stuff. We do some EFT. We do some NLP exercises. We do loads of stuff around mindset and obviously nutrition and just everything really to do with, well, self-care and sobriety. But then, of course, you've got all the fabulous facilities of Champneys. And we also do yoga nidra, which is amazing relaxation. And these retreats are for you if you are sober curious, maybe you're just starting to think about it. Or if you've been sober for years, we had someone on the last retreat who's been sober for 6 years, but really wanted to now to focus on her well-being and her mindset. So it is a great weekend if you're interested in that. So again, if you have a look at the Sober Club, you click on events, you'll find the information there. If you go to direct to Champneys website, you'll need to click on health management. I think you do it that way around. I think you go to health management and then click on retreats, or it might be the other way around. It might be champneys.com/retreats and then health management. And it's called self-care in sobriety. So it'll be just amazing to meet some of you there, some listeners on that occasion. So yeah, check out our Champneys events. And obviously, I have to mention my book again. I've been doing loads of radio interviews, which has been really good fun. Some really small stations, but it's been great fun chatting to people about the book. As I think I said before, it's funny that the questions that I'm asked, many of them are, you know, the same kind of questions. Did you have a rock bottom moment? No, I didn't, but definitely a grey area drinker, those kind of questions. But then different presenters will pick out different bits of the book. And sometimes it's something that I'd completely forgotten that I'd written, or something that someone else has written for me, because don't forget, I've got lots of contributors in the book. And the other day, completely out of the blue, a presenter said, "Oh, and tell me all about yoga nidra." And I spoke a bit about that. And somebody else was asking about EFT, because we talk about emotional freedom technique in the book. So it's been really good just to talk about lots of different aspects. But if you haven't got it yet, it's called Happy, Healthy, Sober: Ditch the Booze and Take Control of Your Life. And you can get it in anywhere you would get, you know, your books online. I'm told you can even get it in Australia, which is good news from Booktopia, I think it is. Somebody mentioned, one of the Sober Club members mentioned that she managed to get it there. And of course, if you have got the book, I'd hugely appreciate a review. Leave me a review on Amazon if you would be willing to. It makes a really big difference to how many people get to know about it. So I'd really appreciate that, of course. Anyways, without further ado, let me bring you Emma.
My guest is author, columnist, speaker, mum of four, and cancer survivor, Emma Campbell. She was first diagnosed with breast cancer back in 2010 when her triplets, oh my goodness, were 6 months old. I have to talk more about that, Em. Oh my goodness, triplets. Her book, All That Followed, A Story of Cancer Kids and the Fear of Leaving Too Soon, was published in 2018. She was diagnosed with secondary breast cancer in 2014 and has worked hard to overcome the anxiety that crippled her for so long. We'll talk more about the other work that you do, Em. I just really wanted to chat to you on the podcast. I've known you for a while, because we should say that you're also married to Sober Dave. and of course, I met Dave when I think Dave actually came along to one of the events I did.
When I was
first sober. So I did some events in London, and I think Dave kind of stumbled in when he was only a few weeks sober, yeah, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, so
absolutely. I remember it well. I remember him talking about it and all those early days of him nervously turning up to an event, you know,
that's
on his
right.
own.
That's right. You know. I remember. And he came and said hi. And then we had a few, I mean, those events were great fun. And we had a few great guests. We had Claire Pooley and Scott and Laura from Club Soda. And a few people came along, and Dave came to most of them, that, you know, we did them sort of weekly or couple every other week. And he came to most of them, and actually watching his transformation was amazing. You know,
incredible,
just amazing.
It?
What a transformation. And look at all the
goodness.
Stuff he's doing now, and just absolute Instagram legend, you know.
He's beaten me as well.
I'm nowhere on the scale, me. I'm Billy No Mates, but you know, I do too many other things to focus on one. But yeah,
absolutely.
So it's been amazing to see Dave's career path, as it were, with the whole being a sober influencer. Is that the expression? A sober influencer. And I think it's amazing, you know, the work that Dave is able to do, because for a while there weren't enough men in this kind of field sort of talking to other men. Sometimes men like to talk to other guys. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
Right? But anyways, you know, the point I'm trying to make is right from the very first time I met Dave, he spoke about you and the fact that, you know, you have triplets, and yeah, that you'd been through cancer. And I didn't know much about it at that point, but, you know, whenever I met him, he would talk about you. And then of course we got to meet. But then it's only sort of over the, I don't know, whatever it is, couple of years that I've seen some of your work and seen some of the stuff you've done, and just realized just what an unbelievable, I mean, just so incredibly inspirational, you know, are just absolutely off the scale inspirational. And I know your Instagram kind of handle is Limitless M, and that is really exactly what you are, isn't it? You are literally limitless. My goodness, it probably doesn't always feel like that to you.
Not at all. Well, actually, the funny thing about that was that my Instagram handle until a couple of years ago was M+4, because I was Emma with all the kids, you know, and that's kind of how I was known by everybody. And the Limitless kind of change came about when I received my third cancer diagnosis 2 years ago. And it was more of a kind of, rather than, oh, I'm so limitless, it was more of a daily reminder to myself. Yeah. It was a kind of, I've got to go into this in a different way, and I've got to kind of tap into my own, really tap in now, you know, after years of just about surviving emotionally with everything. It was a kind of time for a new mindset and a new approach.
Sure. So even before we talk about the cancer diagnosis, I mean, my goodness, you know, having triplets is a thing, right?
It certainly is. I'm still
a thing.
Oh,
I mean,
my goodness.
Oh my goodness. I'm absolutely in awe of you. I really am. I remember years and years ago when my older two were I only had the two, and they were something like 17 months apart, so they were quite close in age.
Yes.
And I remember going along to the church I used to go to in London, sort of with one in a buggy and one in a in a, you know, sling, and there was another family at the church who just had triplets, and they kind of making jokes about how they had one in the sling and one in either pocket of his trousers. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, if I'm finding this hard, what is life like with triplets? Just tell me what those early years were like.
I mean, well, the early years were kind of absolutely bonkers, really. Yeah. I mean, and in a way, without being too heavy, sadly, I kind of look back and think it's almost quite painful to look at some of the photos, because there was so much going on at that time. Yeah. And having spent, you know, 4-ish years desperately wanting a second baby and going through recurrent miscarriage, you know, secondary infertility, then, you know, one round of miraculous IVF and suddenly finding out that we were having three.
Wow.
It was just kind of, And then life just going down the crazy path it did with my diagnosis and becoming a single mum, it was this hamster wheel of survival for their early years. And, you know, by a miracle, they were all healthy and a good weight, and they thrived from day one. But I would be lying if I said it wasn't an incredibly challenging time. Yeah, and it's funny, it's like, it really was. I mean, just goes without saying all the practicalities, you know, for the first 6 months of their life, you know, I was living with them in a second floor flat, you know, so even just getting them out of the house would be a kind of, I wrote about this in my book, the kind of whole, you know, Jake was too young to go to the shop and get the milk, my 7-year-old at the time. So it would be kind of going out once a day to get a pint of milk was like the task of the day.
Absolutely.
So you kind of lying babies in the communal hall while you kind of run up and down with the other one and then bouncing the big triple buggy down the stairs. Yeah, absolutely crazy. But
yeah. And then how old were the triplets and your older child when you were first diagnosed then?
So I was diagnosed when they were about 6 months old and Jake was nearly seven. So, and then I embarked on the full kind of, you know, range of treatment. So chemo, mastectomy, reconstruction, radiotherapy. So it was it kind of sadly stole that time of just being able to be a mum and just focus on. And I think that triggered so much of obviously getting a cancer diagnosis is frightening, but I think as a single parent, as a parent of longed for babies, you know, any parent would know that feeling. Your biggest fear is not being here.
Of course.
And I think the circumstances around their birth were so dramatic that then to kind of add cancer into the mix, I recovered very, very well. You know, it was a really tough time, but physically I recovered. I was young, strong, physically resilient, and I went into remission, and everything was great on that front. But emotionally, it was really tough because, you know, how do you let go of that fear of recurrence and that fear of what would happen to the kids if, you know? So, yeah. And then the kind of irony, those kind of toddler years, nursery, kind of, you know, coming through the sleepless nights and the terrible twos, and we hit the kind of 4 or 5 years old mark, and it was like, wow, I've done it, I'm well, they're starting school, Jake was at secondary school, it was like, right, I've come through the most insanely difficult period. And then, you know, unfortunately, that's when my cancer came back.
Right.
But just at the time, just literally, I met Dave, you know, for the first time the day after I was told that I had cancer again. So wow. These two extremes, I often feel that my life has been full of immense kind of, you know, the wonderful feeling of falling head over heels in love, but absolutely walking alongside, you know, facing
the highs and the lows.
Yeah, the highs and lows, extraordinary.
And I know Dave talks about, you know, quite openly, very openly, about how in those, you know, early years with you, when the kids were very young, you know, he was sort of slotting into a ready-made family and a massive one.
Yeah, he's found it really hard.
Yeah, and he often talks about how much he was drinking at that point.
Yes,
which must have been incredibly difficult for you. I know he won't mind you sharing.
No, not at all.
I mean, what role did alcohol play for you or in that early?
Well, it's incredible, really, because it sounds so naive to say it, but it wasn't until he moved in with us. So at that point, he'd sold his, you know, we'd got together as I was re-diagnosed. Within a year, 11 months later, he'd sold his house and moved in with me and the 4 kids to our very small little, you know, new build house with one loo and, you know, tiny bedrooms, so and very thin walls. Mm. And he just wasn't, it was just a total shock on many, many levels.
Yeah.
But naively, it wasn't until he, 6 months in, I couldn't work out why we were arguing all the time and what was happening to him every night when as his personality changed and the nitpicking and the dog with a bone. And I put so much of it down to he's adjusting to kind of suddenly being stepdad. You know, the kids, particularly the triplets, love them so much, but behavior has been quite a challenge at times, you know, quite wild. And it took me a while for it to kind of dawn on me that, oh my God, he's... So when we met, you know, drinking, I knew that he could hold his beer, so to speak. He's a big guy, he's a strong guy, but because we were in our bubble of love, we weren't having any external stresses at that point. So I just saw this lovely kind of cuddly drunk guy. But I was also, you know, that we'd falling in love. So date nights, and even though I was going through chemo, I'd go and stay at his house, and luckily, naturally, a very moderate drinker. So I'd have a couple of glasses of Prosecco as a treat to myself and my unwinding time, but he would be knocking it back. But I never saw any red flags. And because without going into it too much, my previous relationship had been very dramatic and volatile, and there had been the alcohol part of it had played out in a very, very different way, much more, you know, kind of the drama around it. So I just, and I remember saying to my best friend at the time, God, it's so lovely to be with someone who doesn't have an issue with drink. I mean, can you believe it? And then, and this is, he won't mind me saying this, it was the sold sign, or the under offer sign, was outside his house. We were having our very last meal. He was due to complete the following Wednesday. We were having like a takeaway at his house for the very last time. And he said, I've got something to tell you. What? I'm a functioning alcoholic. And I just remember like my jaw dropping, you know, midway through this lovely, lovely meal and toasting our time there and our new future. And I just couldn't take in what he was saying. And I did what I'm pretty good at and have been very good at. I went into complete denial. And it was almost like, no, you're not, you can't be. And also, what the hell do I do with that information? Because you've sold your house. I love you so much. We're planning our whole life. What do I do with that? Do I say, well, sorry, mate, you know, what it was too enormous. And I just had to kind of put it somewhere in my brain. I compartmentalized it and I brushed it off. And then again, you know, it like I said, it took a good few months before I put two and two together and thought, hang on a minute, his personality is changing every single night of the week at around 8 o'clock.
Yeah.
Because he's a bottle and a half, 2 bottles in.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of a very, you know, the love never wavered, but it was a very, very difficult time.
And then
until he gave up.
Yeah. How much longer after that was it then till?
So he gave up in 2019, right at the beginning of 2019. He moved in probably 4 or 5 years. I mean, we came close to breaking point on several occasions, you know, and it was, but I never, ever imagined that he would stop, because he never talked about stopping. It was only in those last few months where he said we'd have another horrendous row, another scene. You know, it was starting to become a toxic situation again. And I'd fought so hard as a mother, you know, to kind of create a stability for the kids and a drama-free environment. And suddenly, the guilt I felt that, you know, Dave, very different, because Dave's fundamentally such a decent, good guy. But, you know, as you know, the effect of alcohol changes.
It absolutely,
you know,
changes.
It can change the personality.
Completely.
So it was, it got to the point where, you know, we were having some very unpleasant scenes. And I had found myself back in a dramatic, fairly toxic situation.
Yeah,
but then again, it was confusing, because he was very highly functioning. So he would wake up the next morning, be lovely, be kind of,
course,
my God.
I don't,
and then go on and do a 12-hour day at work and be responsible and pay bills. And
I think when I interviewed him, you know, for the podcast, I think he did say that there came a point where he knew it was going to be you or the drink. He was going to have to choose. You know, it's such an interesting one, isn't it? Because this story will be being replicated, you know, in so
Absolutely.
Many houses across the UK, won't it? And not necessarily just the guy, it might be the woman, you know, it
Completely.
Can be, you know, or whatever the relationship, whatever sex you are. Alcohol doesn't care who it takes as prisoner, right? But but this dynamic, this relationship dynamic, it's just, and the really sad thing, of course, is that so many people never challenge it. They never get to the point where they challenge it. And imagine what it's like if both parents are drinking. I mean, this is what scares me over lockdown. You know, if you've got both people drinking and there's no one to challenge the other, I mean, what
Absolutely.
A nightmare.
It's
very difficult for the kids as well, isn't it? Because
completely.
Children
and it got
must feel very unsettled.
Yeah, and it got to the point, of course, you know, because, and again, you're adding in the step family, the step parent, the blended family dynamics. So that already, that's quite challenging, you know. And so you've got a teenager, you've got triplets that are growing and observing more and more. You've got him not being his best self because he's dealing with his increasingly damaging addiction. Me going back into that hypervigilant state as a partner of kind of just wanting it, keeping the peace, do you know what I mean? And being so protective of the kids. And it just was this cycle of, I'd pull away from him, be overprotective of the kids. He'd be angry and feel unsupported and unheard. But the most I felt, and I just naively, because I've been fortunate enough not to experience that dependency, I just prayed that he would somehow one day wake up and magically be able to moderate. You know, why don't we just have one bottle of wine on a Friday night? Why don't you just have one bottle of wine on a Friday night? You know, not understanding that that just couldn't happen. The realization that moderation is not an option for someone who's gone to a certain point with their drinking.
Absolutely. Well, if you don't have an off switch, you don't.
So
tell us a bit more about what happened for you then. So when obviously Dave, you know, sorted himself out, which is amazing. Tell us more about about you know, what happened for you and how you dealt with that second shock, really, with the cancer.
Yes. So actually, when the second shock was when we met in end of 2014, that's when I had the first recurrence. And then 2 years ago, sort of a week or 10 days after Dave gave up drinking, I was told that my cancer had progressed again. So it again, you know, bringing it back to that side of things, what timing, what extraordinary timing to quit the booze when your wife has you know, you're about to embark as a family, as a couple, on another very, very difficult journey. So incredible respect for him for sticking to that. And it meant that, of course, he was there for, as he often says, he was able to be there for me and to be present for me.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was incredible. And so it was the beginning of, as devastating, as frightening as it was to get a new diagnosis, I've been very, very lucky up to now, where each time with my cancer, okay, it's not great, but it's been fairly contained. And, you know, I've responded very, very well to treatment. So I remain on targeted chemo, but, you know, I'm back in remission again. And so we just got our heads down. We got through the you know, lung surgery, second mastectomy, very difficult year physically. But because he was sober and we were rock solid, and the healing began in our marriage.
Yeah.
You know, and that was very precious and as a family. And so, yeah, so I remain kind of, as far as I know, I think I'm in, no active disease at the moment. And I'm just kind of, I think we're both on a path of, because it's interesting, there are so many parallels. You know, there's his denial as a dependent drinker, alcoholic, whatever you call it, my denial as a cancer patient who didn't act on symptoms. Both of us kind of in this place in the last couple of years of incredible growth and realization, personal realizations, and kind of this united desire to kind of really show that change is possible, and that we do have, you know, limitless potential, and we can transform our limiting beliefs, and we can overcome the toughest of times. So I think personally for me, that's my passion, and that's the kind of message, you know, if I think back to the me of 11 years ago as a young mom with babies, newly diagnosed, gosh, if I could just put some of what I've learned,
exactly,
into that head, or then that's because kind of what I feel,
you know,
very,
I was just
saying,
I mean, to look at you, you know, you look incredibly healthy. You look amazing, actually. And I know that you haven't just sort of sat around waiting for treatments. I mean, my goodness. I mean, am I right in thinking you
ran the marathon?
My God. I mean, that's just what the hell? That's off the scale.
I mean,
that's
just
off. That's bonkers. How on earth can any? I can't get my head around how anyone can do that. Really,
when it
became incredible.
The running again, it's become something, you know, over the years in my 20s, 30s, I'd kind of run a bit always when I was like, oh God, I feel a muffin top coming on or whatever. It was always that kind of low self-esteem running. It was just to shrink myself, you know, that kind of unhealthy approach that I'd go through for a few months, then stop again. This time round, I discovered running again just after the diagnosis through meeting a new friend, Bryony Gordon, and we just connected, and she said, why don't you come on a run with me? And it was like, what? I'm on new chemo, but you know, the chemo I'm on is fairly kind of manageable in terms of side effects. And it just instantly became this, along with the new friendship that I forged very quickly with her, and this almost like these early morning therapy sessions that we both have.
Well, of course, Bryony's had her own very vocal journey with the booze, hasn't she?
Exactly. So we had so much to connect us, but it's become this measure of my, it's not for everybody. And I know that running isn't for everybody. For me, it's become a very positive measure of my mental kind of state and my physical state. And you know, on the year that I began running, I knew that I had lung surgery looming, I had a mastectomy looming, and I was scared. And, you know, I'm always going to be someone who goes to very dark places at times with anxiety and fear. That's my nature. But there's something about when you're, however slowly I run, however much I stop to walk and pause for breath, none of that matters. None of that matters. But every time I'm out there on the common, whatever, putting one foot in front of the other, I am showing up for myself.
Yeah,
and I am, my body is reminding me that it's not cancer. And that was a huge realization for me a couple of years ago of, okay, my left boob was cancer, to, you know, it came back in the other boob, you know, but my legs aren't cancer.
The whole smile
isn't cancer. My heart. Yeah. And it's all about this kind of belief that I have. So about diminishing the things that aren't working and kind of expanding on the stuff in our life that is going well. So it's just helped me to, rather than cancer be this shadow that just engulfs me night and day, I've somehow managed to shrink it.
We hear, don't we, of and you must have experienced this all the time, that, you know, when you get, if you have cancer, you know, within the sort of, you become a number in the system.
Yeah.
You know, you become that statistic.
That one in two, or that one in three.
That, you know, you're a cancer patient. It's like, what the hell, no, I'm way more than that, aren't you? You are so much more than that.
And especially when you're kind of in that, you know, that grim sounding stage 4/incurable category, which on paper I am, because I will always be a cancer patient. But I just choose not to identify too
strongly
with that. And that doesn't mean that I'm in, you know, it's trying also not to, it's not about minimizing the enormity of it or dismissing anyone else's. It's just thinking, I have to manage this for the rest of my life. I have to find a way. And because for so many years, I just was treading water.
Yeah.
And that's it's no way to live, you know.
And how do you support your own well-being now then? Because I'm sure that's you know, a big part of it,
also
taking responsibility sort of thing.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, like I said, the running has become is an integral part of that. I kind of, you know, lockdown's been interesting in realizing how much, you know, I've always known that I enjoy my own, I need my own space. I like my own company. Having kind of, you know, I have begun to really not meditate by sitting cross-legged, but on the floor, but just kind of really be selective about just the things I listen to and uplifting conversations and just kind of self, you know, I've become much more aware of the importance of soothing myself in whatever way. I mean, diet wise and lifestyle wise, I'm one of those people that I go through phases where I think I can survive on a cup of tea and a biscuit in the morning and then go for a run and then kind of grab something hot, and then I crash and burn a bit. So that's a work in progress for me to kind of really think, right, get the greens in, get the NutriBullet out, you know, drink enough water. That's something that is a bit of an ongoing
the emotional side of it all, you know, you've obviously found a way to squish down some of those limiting beliefs and that fear. Yeah. And it, you know, it's been interesting over lockdown, hasn't it, to see the number of people who completely understandably have been in such fear. And of course, fear lowers immunity, right?
Absolutely.
And once you allow all these unbelievably terrifying thoughts to just be constantly running your life, it's really, really difficult. And I'm guessing part of what you've done you've had to learn. It's not something, I mean, I wish we could learn this stuff in school, right? But
I know
you've had to learn, haven't you, how to control, how to change your thoughts, because we can control our thoughts.
We can, and we are the only thinkers in our mind, aren't we? And we are in charge of the thoughts that we think and the words that we choose to speak. And you know, I had a really low patch a couple of weeks ago, and I really wasn't able to walk the talk. You know, I felt defeated by my thoughts. But on the whole, I absolutely feel like I know whether this is my truth, that if I can shift, if I can reset, reframe, if I can tell a different story, you know, and create my, you know, Dave will often say to me sometimes in a kind of, oh, you got to face reality. And I'm like, actually, I don't want to face reality. I want to create my reality. Yeah. I want to fill my mind up with big thoughts of a future, exactly. Thought of being here. And it's been interesting with the COVID thing, because obviously it's been devastating, and there's no denying the loss and the pain that's gone on for so many thousands and thousands of people. But for whatever reason, I hadn't felt any fear around it on a personal level. And probably that's because so much of my fear goes into the other big C. But it's been interesting, God, seeing the level of fear that has gripped people, that you wouldn't people that we know that maybe it wouldn't have expected that person to react in that way. And often I think, is that because we're just watching the news over and over
again,
drowning in it. And I think, is it helping me to watch the headlines on repeat throughout the day? And again, like I said, it's not about being in denial, but it's just about, how is that serving me? What about if I just turn the news off and just look up and look out and think, okay, and work on just thinking about things that make us feel good, that make us give us, and it's not about, you can't go from a place of crippling fear to ecstatic joy, but you can go from a place of fear and anxiety to a notch up the scale. You can go from fear to a little bit of hope or a little bit of relief.
And I guess gratitude comes in as well. And
hugely.
And that, and that must have been, you know, that's difficult for you in the beginning because you're bound to have that feeling of why me in all this? I can only begin to imagine that those feelings are huge. You are, you know, you feel like a victim at the beginning, don't you? I'm guessing. And I can tell that you've brought in gratitude and that gives everything another whole level.
That was the beginning for me. I was actually writing about this today as I'm kind of thinking of you know, ideas for books and stuff. It began for me, my shift began with the idea of practicing gratitude, which I'd always kind of peripherally known, you know, the importance. I'd spent years reading all the sort of self-help books and self-development books, but actually applying it and realizing, you know, that anxiety and gratitude cannot occupy the same space.
Yes.
So replace anxiety with gratitude. And for me, it began very, very simply with, you know, as any patient, anyone waiting for news, sitting by your phone, waiting for the no caller ID, sitting in an oncology waiting room, there's very little that can take away how traumatic that can be. So it almost began with me with very simply, almost even if in a mind-numbing way, just sort of mumbling thank you over and over, you know, thank you for the chair that I'm sitting on, for the tea out of the polystyrene cup, for the cellophane wrapped bourbon biscuits, you know, that you get when you're in the, it's like just anything. And the more, and it brings you back to the present.
Yes, exactly.
It brings you back to the right now there. And therefore, because anxiety is all about the future, isn't it?
Exactly.
It's all about what we're imagining.
What's coming.
Yeah. Mm. And so that was my first kind of go-to. And actually, you know, my one and only tattoo that I got done on my wrist the day before chemo started again 2 years ago is gratitude, as that reminder. And so again, I don't want to sound like I don't always manage it, but I know that for me, they are my core beliefs. So gratitude then led to this feeling of, once that became established and just saying thank you to everything, the good and the bad, just kind of
embracing,
you know,
all the emotions.
Yeah, embracing all of it. Mm. And then somehow realizing that the more you shift to the good, that led to me then shifting my focus more to what I said at the beginning of our chat, the kind of, okay, this is feeling a bit shit right now, but this is good. This area of my life's flowing and working. And then you just, it's kind of, you know, I describe it as turning the volume up and turning the volume down.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And those are my anchors.
What would your top tip be then for anyone who is suffering from, you know, or just feeling fearful and overwhelmed for whatever reason, not necessarily an illness?
I would say if you feel in the grip of those kind of catastrophic thoughts, my kind of approach now is to just go try to sort of be quite general about your thoughts, because you can't, again, don't think that you can eliminate those thoughts in one go and be bouncing off the ceiling. You can't. So it's just kind of pivoting almost. So pivoting away from that sort of mindset of disaster and impending doom to, right, okay, this minute I'm just making myself that cup of tea in my favorite mug. Oh, you know, breathe. Right. I'm going to light that candle, that lovely candle I've been saving. I'm going to have whatever it is, just soft. It is self-soothing. It's gradually kind of nudging yourself into a better feeling place.
Yeah.
And, you know, without repeating, it's just a shift. It's just pigeon steps, baby steps into a place of ease and relief. I think any thought that gives you a feeling of, it's very much kind of, you know, law of attraction kind of a philosophy of just going for what feels good, you know. And when you really, really can't switch off those thoughts, when you're really having a kind of episode of being gripped by fear, then almost think, I'm going to go to sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm going to try and reset. And when you wake up in the morning, be really mindful of, it's so easy. So many of us wake up in the morning with a feeling of impending doom, don't we? And overwhelm and anxiety. And actually every morning when we wake up, we have a chance to reset.
Yeah.
Even if we're facing the same issues that we were facing the day before. It's like, okay, right. And breaking the day down into manageable chunks. Mm, yeah. And
do you I know you've written your book and you're on the way to writing a second one. Do you also write that sort of the stuff I talk
journaling,
about a lot?
Yeah.
In the Sober Club, we talk a lot about the kind of stream of consciousness, morning pages.
Absolutely.
Thing. Do you do that to get your thoughts out?
Hugely. I mean, I go through phases. I did the Artist's Way, which you probably know. Years ago. And it was, God, it was a huge shift for me. And I do something called a dream day journal. Early in the morning, I'll write how I want life to be as though it's happening.
Yeah.
So I get up and then I've got this exciting phone call, and then I go and do this. And actually, you're kind of writing it into reality. Mm. So yeah, it's something. Yeah, it's just another lovely tool. And I've actually, I'm about to launch there was a point a while ago where I was doing filter-free writing workshops where it was, sitting with a group of people, no experience necessary, and really just kind of using lovely prompts to get our imagination going, working with memory, and also kind of unearthing, the kind of thing, that kind of excavating of our dreams and desires and getting them down on the page. So I'm hoping to start doing some. Well, I think I'm going to do some virtual ones in this crazy time.
Brilliant. It is amazing how just writing those thoughts down, and it's really interesting because years and years ago, before I became aware of all of this, I used to think, well, I suppose there was a little part of me that thought, if I write this stuff down, I'll kind of make it real, and I don't want to do that. So it's almost as though sometimes we're afraid of our own thoughts. A scary thought will come in and we just want to push it away. Or in my case, numb it out with a drink.
That's
what I used to do, which felt terrifying. So, it feels scary. I don't like it at all. Quickly just have a drink. Don't have to think about it again.
Oh my God, absolutely.
But when you realize that actually, it's Louise Hay, of course, you can't I forget what the exact phrase was, but the essence is you can't heal what you can't see. You've got to have it out before you can clean it,
And actually,
you can't clean a house if you can't see the dirt. That was what she said.
Yeah, exactly. But I remember actually talking of the Artist's Way, and I remember a bit that stuck with me from Julia Cameron's book was, the morning pages can be like a brain drain, can't
yes,
it? You
exactly.
can just get everything,
yeah,
all the
yeah.
oh
dump it all.
Oh, I feel this, I feel that. But actually, and it's so true, you can't complain. You can't write down what isn't working day after day, morning after morning, without actually thinking, hang on a minute, either this is getting a bit boring, I'm bored of myself repeating this same misery, or you just slowly start to kind of, but hang on, the light bulbs start to come. So that's another really good way of looking at it.
It is, it's really true. And I find that, that sometimes some of the things that we find ourselves writing down in this kind of stream of consciousness stuff, we remember them later in the day or the next day. We actually the thought comes back. We remember having written it down. Yeah. And let's say it was some kind of dilemma we had. The answer would just pop in.
Oh, incredible.
That's the amazing bit, isn't it? Whereas if we'd never allowed ourselves to even consciously acknowledge the dilemma, as it were, it would just carry on, disturbing us at some kind of low level.
Yeah, because we're connecting to our own, we're allowing ourselves the space to connect to our own truth and our own innate wisdom, I guess, because we do essentially, I was writing about this just like an hour ago. It's like the way I used to seek answers from everybody else. I'd almost ask the lady at the bus stop, what do you think? What do you think I should do? Not literally, but that kind of feeling of, when you've just got that, you just want to tell your story over and over again, wanting everyone else to kind of give you the answers. And it's like, no, I know my own truth, whether I choose to kind of hear it. And, again, all of this is a work in progress, and there's no arrival point where we've suddenly got the answers. Just recently with a couple of situations of conflicts that really threw me, with a couple of friendships and I went back into that very obsessive overthinking, what do you think? What do you think? And I've only just come out of that. So but I still know, even in the times when I'm not able to quite practice those tools, I know that they're the tools that do work.
Yeah, great.
Well,
I really appreciate those tips. It's so, so, so helpful. And what would your tip be then? Tip sounds so flippant, but what would you say to anyone listening who is in the situation that you were in with, when Dave was drinking too much, anyone who has a partner?
Yeah.
Because it's such a difficult one, isn't it? Because you love that person and, oh my goodness, I've no idea. I'm sure you won't have an answer, but would you have anything to suggest to someone who's in that situation?
The only thing that kind of comes to mind, and I've heard myself sort of say it a few times to people in the last couple of years, is that you get so, codependent, we know what codependency, and it does become, as the partner, you do develop some very unhealthy habits as the partner, because you're just, like, as I said, smoothing it over, enabling.
Well, I was just about to say, does the enabling come into it?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. Yes. But I think, and I remember many, many, many a night, because it got to the point where we were barely sleeping in the same, we didn't have a spare bedroom. I was either sleeping on the sofa or he was. And I remember one night sort of staring up into the back garden from the living room sofa, looking at the rooftops thinking, what the hell am I going to do here? On a practical front, you're married, you're living with someone, you're sharing your life together. You can't just walk away, can't. And you don't just boot them out at the first sign of, it doesn't work like that. And when all those complex emotions, but I do remember the kind of, when you asked that question, I suppose the thing I want to say is we absolutely have the right to not live with that level we have the right to happiness, and we have the right to, whether we can take the step there and then, it might not, but just claim and acknowledge to ourselves that our happiness has to be as important
as those
that we love.
It comes back to self-care, I suppose, doesn't it? And just being really upfront about that. So it's not that you're necessarily, telling the other person what to do, but it's hugely important to say how you feel. And you are right. I have spoken to a couple of people. I've had a couple of guests on the podcast who went through this for years and years before relationships ended in their case. Yeah. And what they both said, if I remember back in not so many words, was that they just wish so much that they hadn't let it go on for so long.
Yeah.
Effectively enabling and putting themselves last, and the kids in many cases. It's such a difficult one though, because
it really is.
When you're on the other side, I never forget that this could have been me, the other way around. It could so easily have been me. And if my husband had said to me, you're drinking too much, I'm going to leave. Oh my God. I mean, I wish I could say that would have shocked me into going, oh my goodness, thank you so much for saying that. You know what? I'm going to stop now.
Yeah.
But I think it would have sent me the other way.
Well, this is the thing. And Dave often says, I didn't ever give him an ultimatum. I didn't ever say, right, but it became very clear. I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah. Come back to you, I suppose, really.
And by some miracle, that must have gone in.
Yes.
And he did do it for himself, but he did it for us as well, and himself. And again, I often think we both wake up sometimes. Even my daughter, Dave's stepdaughter, came into the bedroom the other morning and said, oh, Mum, I dreamt that Dave was drinking again. He got really drunk.
Oh, bless.
It's like he stopped.
Even the kids have the drinking dreams.
Yeah, but it's like he stopped in the nick of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by every day I sort of say, a little prayer of gratitude that he hasn't relapsed.
Yeah,
and, I don't know if we'd gone into that cycle of stop, start, that's a whole other area of hell, I think. Yeah. And I honestly don't know.
Yeah. I think I would have
got to a real rock bottom, but I don't know what my rock bottom would have been, because I never stopped loving him. And it was the, how do we separate? What does that mean? I've got, even if I'd stopped loving him, it's like on so many levels, how would we have managed that? So I think,
I guess it's a little bit like with children, you know, when they always say in term, you know, in the parenting manuals, they always say that you should never say to a child, you know, I don't like you. It's I don't like that behavior at that time. And I guess it's the same in a way. But the way that alcohol changes a person is quite incredible and absolutely bloody frightening, if truth be told.
It really is.
You hear people say, he isn't the same person, she isn't the same girl when she's drinking.
I know, and
you know, I don't want to get too woo-woo on you, but actually they really aren't.
I totally agree.
You know, there's a reason why these drinks are called spirits, because there's something else takes over.
No, I was just going to say, because it's when you don't have a drink problem, in inverted commas, we all know that feeling. I know, you know, if I'm at a party, well, the rare, you know, when we used to be at parties, of course I change. Of course I do. Whether I just get more relaxed, I tend to get either a bit weepy, extra cuddly, or I invite the whole party to some, let's all go on a holiday together. You know, I do those kind of, I go into that kind of mode if I'm on a social thing and I've had a few too many drinks. It's the kind of, let's all do that next Sunday. And then you kind of think, what was that? But you know, it's thankfully, but Dave's sobriety has of course had a really positive effect on me and my view of drinking as well. I've become much more mindful, even if I didn't really need to be mindful, if you know what I mean. And I'm really, really aware of having, you know, of the drink-free days outweighing the drinking days. And it was lovely, actually. My eldest son is about to be 18, and we've got a friend who's in our support bubble, and he was around quite recently, and he said, "Jake, do you ever have a beer? Do you ever help yourself to a beer?" And he went, "No, there's never any alcohol in our house." and I said, And I said, "Well, if there was, would you? If there were beers in the fridge, because I never drink beer." And he went, "No, probably not." And you know, I'm sure his time will come, and he'll step into that. You know, he'll start going to parties and stuff. But it was quite nice to think, "Oh, yeah, we're not. We used to have. We used to have the most ridiculous array when Dave was drinking of bottles of this and bottles of that, and that's all gone. You know, and it's great. It's great."
Oh, thank you so much, Em. It's just so lovely to chat to you. So I love the sound of your writing workshops. What a wonderful idea.
Yes, I'll let you know. I'm about to kind of, just put that out there. And I think it'd just be a lovely, safe, informal space for us all to...
Brilliant. You know. And I look forward to your next book coming out as well.
People
can get hold of the first one, All That Followed, A Story of Cancer Kids and the Fear of Leaving Too Soon. That came out 2018. So we can grab hold of that. And let us know when your next one comes out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. It's so lovely to chat to you. Thanks ever so
really
much.
Good.
Bye.
Take care.
So you can follow Emma on Instagram and don't forget to follow me as well if you haven't already, at Janie Lee Grace, and similarly on social media if you want to go on Facebook. I mean Facebook, not social media. I'm also on Twitter at Janie Lee Grace. Facebook, you can look at Happy Healthy Sober if you want to. And obviously, you know where to find me. If you want connection, inspiration, accountability, support, content, all of the above, check out thesoberclub.com. And don't forget, if you've got any suggestions for me for a great guest for the podcast, it's always worth giving them a try. I've got some super good guests coming up in the future. I'm really excited. Going to be bringing you Lara from Happy AF Group in Australia. Who else have I got lined up? Oh, I'm looking to interview Dr. Adi Jaffe. Really looking forward to that. Fascinating guy. So lots to come. Have yourself a great week. If you're struggling, always, always, always reach out. Always reach out for help, because, you know, there's always someone to catch you. There really, really is. And just know that what you're doing is the best thing you will ever do for your health and well-being. See you soon. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.